Was this just his peers' method of denying him by damning the greatest mind in all Grotdom to failure simply because they couldn't be bothered to help? Then Gip stepped forward.
Underboss sounds good. I'm in. Nice one,
Snaggy grinned at him and turned to look at the crowd again with slightly more expectation.
Who's next?
He got five more in the end. Swipe, Nib, Longtooth, whom Snaggy immediately distrusted, Moz and Bees. Geki Shortnose very obviously didn't volunteer and just stared challengingly at Snaggy. That was his mistake. Snaggy Littletooth didn't back down from any challenge, or at least not one thrown down by a grot he could spank with one arm tied behind his back.
Come on, lads,
he said, addressing his new cronies and soon-to-be underbosses.
Let's go get us a spiky.
They stepped out of the battle wagon's ruin, and he looked around cautiously. The immediate threat was unlikely to come from the spikies themselves. Rather, it was probably going to be from a runt herd. They hated to see a grot go unwhipped, and the last thing Snaggy wanted was to be drubbed into a massed group of his supposed followers and herded off to fight something. He had killed a runt herd before, of course, but best not to trust that he could do it again.
Right, keep your eyes peeled,
he advised, as they scurried from cover to cover, taking shelter behind wrecked orc vehicles, shot up spiky walls and barricades, and on one occasion, even the bodies of a couple of orcs who'd clearly ended up on the wrong end of some of the spiky's poison shards. He pointed at where a bloody chunk of spiky lay. Slippery zoggers that they were, by the time an orc actually managed to land a weapon on one of them, they weren't taking any chances about it getting away.
It ain't going to be easy to find one of these gits in one piece. Actually, boss,
Moz said, tapping him on the shoulder and pointing ahead of them.
I don't think that's going to be a problem as such.
Snaggy looked up, and a chill ran straight through him. There was another massive portal over there. It was opening, and it was disgorging death. Chapter 10. Dimera led the attack, riding on her venom. She did not do this out of any sense of nobility or from a notion that an Archon's place was at the front, simply in the knowledge that her craft was swift and orcish reactions often sluggish, and she wanted to be at the front before her enemies filled the sky with so much ordnance that even their woeful inaccuracy became irrelevant. Nor was this how she had planned it. She had envisaged leading, from a withdrawn strategic position, a more numerous, more powerful force, consisting of not only the Port Tavar Cabals and the Coven of the Red Harvest, but also the Witch Cults. That could have cut right into the core of the Horde, as Reavers and Hellions slaughtered them at speed, and the Witch's foot soldiers, pumped high on combat drugs, flipped acrobatically off their raider transports to land like thunderbolts in the Orcs' midst. That would have been a joyous bloodletting, a crimson symphony of the Drukhari's superiority offered up to Kayla Mensha Kane, the god of war. Now, however, things would be much more difficult. The forces of Port Tavar were still deadly in the extreme, but without the witch's additional numbers and superlative speed, they were at far greater risk of being drawn into the sort of attritional battle that would greatly favour their foe. Still, there was nothing for it. Succubi were mercurial, arrogant creatures, and any approach to them that they felt lacked the appropriate amount of respect would do more harm than good. Dimera could not spare the time to wait for honeyed words and reason to sway them to her side. Not when the orcs were teleporting and jeopardizing the survival of her entire realm. Three portals connected Port Tavar to Saber Gate, and the Drukhari swarmed out of all of them at once. No sooner had her craft crossed the threshold than Dimera caught the scent of her enemy. A thick, choking reek that plunged into her nostrils and stayed there, and which felt as though it was coating her airways. There were other smells too. The stink of their crude fuel and its fumes, and the pervasive, pungent odour of the combustible charges that powered their ballistic weaponry. And, by all the void, the noise. Drukhari knew Chulcha. They were the galaxy's preeminent experts in the subtlest torments, the most creative excruciations, in prolonging and wringing out the very last dregs of pain and suffering before a victim's body and mind finally succumbed and they gleefully embraced the release of death. Dimera could still remember the first time she had seen her mother flay something alive in front of her. She had screamed too at first, not knowing why this creature was being hurt. She had wanted it to stop, for not even Drukhari were born with the innate impulse to inflict such pain on other living beings. That came later, as a child grew to understand their culture. Soon, the necessity of others suffering in order to stave off death became pleasurable in and of itself, and cause and effect merged into one. Those that could not accept such reality left Kamora to seek solace with the rustics on the maiden worlds, or with the spineless ascetics on the craft worlds, to wither and die and have their souls trapped forever, rather than constantly replenish them from the agony of others. Yes, Drukhari knew torture, to the point where the blunt methods used by other species were akin to a warm bath and a massage. Nonetheless, Dimera winced as the sheer volume of the orcish horde crashed into her ears, all jagged noise and brutality, painful in its discordant simplicity and volume. There was no sense to which these creatures were not offensive. The orcs had already done a great deal of damage, but as ever with them, there was nothing strategic about it. It was destruction for destruction's sake, obeying a wanton glee that in many other circumstances Dimera would have considered quite admirable. Mighty spires now stood with ragged holes blasted in them. Colonnades had been brought down, and bridges lay broken and ruined far below the spaces they had once spanned. Wreckage was everywhere. Chunks of masonry, immobilized vehicles, and the bloody ruins of butchery, with both orcish and Drukhari bodies strewn about. Even the mighty statue of Asdrubal Vect himself, Dimera was horrified to see, lay smashed and headless. "Find the leader," she snapped, despite the fact that this had already been the instruction issued to her pilot before they came through the gate. "Find it and kill it!" Her venom banked and screamed through the sky with a dozen raiders behind it. Most were hers, but two were from Falling Night and one from Blood's Gift. Ancestral enemies come together to bring death to what was, at the moment at least, a greater threat to them all. The warriors on the transports fired almost indiscriminately into the hall below them, the combined hiss of their splinter rifles rising into a sharp susurration that became audible even through the din of the orcs' war-making. Other weapons spoke as well, the black spitting energy of blasters and dark lances searing out to bring down the orcs' blocky, lumbering warwalkers, their ramshackle vehicles, or particularly large and imposing orcish leaders. And shredders, near silent other than the faint whistle of their barbed, monomolecular nets as they flowed outwards to envelop and eviscerate the lightly armoured brutes beneath. The orcs registered their presence less quickly than Dimera had feared, but sooner than she'd hoped. She had a few precious seconds of almost unchallenged death-dealing, cutting a swathe through the green mass, and then things changed. There was no gradual wave of realization that spread through her foes. One moment her force was flying through clear skies, the next the thunder of orcish weaponry was redirected upwards, almost as one. Her venom's flicker field was active, breaking up the craft's outline and making it harder to target, but such measures did little when the volume of fire was so great and so indiscriminate. The massed roar of the orcs' clumsy but rapid-firing assault weaponry filled the air along with their projectiles, which were largely shrugged off by the skimmer's hulls even if their force fields failed to stop the incoming shots. But orcish weaponry was the epitome of idiosyncratic. Something blew a hole the size of Dimera's head in the Venom's right wing vein. And something else struck one of the engines and sent the craft sputtering unstably to one side for a moment before the pilot managed to right it. Behind her, one raider began spouting black smoke and listing. The warriors on board ceased firing as they struggled to maintain a grip, but mere moments later they were plunged into the ground beneath. The raider struck with a crash and was immediately swarmed by bellowing orcs brandishing weapons. "Mistress!" Zesk shouted in alarm, pointing at snub-nosed shapes that were screaming into view around nearby spires. They were orcish creations, so un-aerodynamic that Dimera could see little explanation for how they were kept aloft, other than the stubborn refusal of their pilots to accept the concept of crashing. They were true aircraft, far faster even than her Venom, and bearing down on her at great speed. "Patience," she said calmly. "All is in hand." Shards of night streaked into view from behind them, a trio of sharp-edged shapes, even faster and more manoeuvrable than the orcish craft. These were razor wings, and the orcs pulled out of their attack run as they became aware of this new threat, or possibly an even more entertaining battle. That danger was gone, but the damage being done to Dimera's escort was continuing. Another raider came apart in midair as some particularly powerful weapon struck it, and one more was limping. Dimera could sense that the warriors following her were on the verge of turning tail. Few Drukhari had any concept of selling their lives dearly if there was any chance of saving them outright, no matter what the subsequent consequences might be. Her pilots were doing their best, jinking and swerving to throw their enemies off, and taking any opportunity to put a turret or walkway between themselves and their attackers. But something needed to change soon. "There!" she shouted, pointing dead ahead of them as they rounded another spire. It was more hope and distraction than anything else, giving her followers something to focus on, a sense that their goal was within reach and therefore it was worth continuing for the few more seconds it would take to achieve it. However, as they streaked towards this particular concentration of orcs, Dimera realised that she might actually have been correct. While nowhere within sight appeared to have been set up as a base of operations as such, she could see more of the orcs' strange machinery here than she had elsewhere, and critically, it was machinery that did not appear to have any obvious use as an offensive weapon or vehicle. What was more, her keen eyes could make out an exceptionally massive orc clad in immense yellow and black armour, who stood a head taller than even the largest other specimens around it. It gestured with a huge weapon that seemed to be part axe and part hammer. The machinery in front of it crackled with power, and an entire mob of the creatures flashed out of existence.
"I have found the leader and the teleportation device," Dimera snapped over carrier wave. "All forces to me."
A barrage of rockets rose up on wobbling smoke trails from her right, and although most fell wide, three struck a raider and blew it apart. Another of her vehicles skewed out of control as something damaged either its steering controls or its thrusters. Some orcs actually emerged out of the mass of their fellows on crude jetpacks, and while at least two were eviscerated by a raider's blade veins and chain snares, the rest either managed their trajectories well enough to land on the deck, or simply got hit by a part of the raider's exterior, but clung on and dragged themselves aboard anyway. Dimera did not give the Drukhari crew good odds of surviving. That did not matter. All the lives around her were disposable, and they were closing in on her prey now.
"Focus all fire," she ordered, pointing her venom blade at the huge orc.
The weapons of her remaining craft and their riders opened up, tracking towards it and the other lesser beasts around it. She was almost on top of it now, and she saw it turn, finally alerted to her approach. She leaned forward gleefully, waiting for dull comprehension to dawn in its tiny red eyes as it saw its death approach. Then something began sparkling, away beyond the orc's leader.
Dimera just had time to realise that what she had assumed was the ruined back half of an orc vehicle was in fact some sort of wheeled artillery piece, when the bulbous-tipped weapon it bore gave one final bright flash, and a wall of translucent energy appeared in front of her, rapidly expanding and pushing everything in front of it, including the startled orcs on the ground. Her pilot began to bank, but even a venom was not nimble enough to avoid this fate when going at full speed. Dimera's reflexes took over, and she leaped clear of her craft just before it, along with most of the remaining raiders, struck the force field bubble. The pinnacle of Camorran engineering, compounds stronger than steel yet far lighter, buckled under the impact. As she fell, Dimera saw her warriors thrown clear and strike the energy wall themselves, but then she had to put all her concentration into landing. Orcs had been shunted forwards and were now crushed together and piled up two or three deep below her, with their bellows giving a good indication of what they thought of this state of affairs. So Dimera braced herself for an uneven landing on footing that was about to try to kill her. She had little doubt that she could best a great number of these beasts in combat, but their sheer physical strength would be her end if any of them managed to actually lay hands on her. As suddenly as it had appeared, the orcish energy flickered and dissipated. It was a weapon then, albeit a very strange one, and not a defensive force field. Dimera landed in a perfect crouch on an orc's back, her weapons in each hand, and leaped away again into the empty ground that had just been swept clear of bodies. The orc chieftain's eyes locked onto hers, and despite herself, Dimera shuddered as she attracted the full attention of this monster. It was truly massive, at least half as tall again as she was. And with the bulky muscle common to its species and the thick armour laid over that, it looked more like one of the Monkees' dreadnought war machines than it did a mortal foe. She knew it had realised she was its opposite number. She suppressed another shudder at the thought of this creature considering itself her equal in any way, and that it would now bend all its will towards her destruction, recognising as she did the strategic importance of eliminating the enemy commander. The orc laughed at her. Sheer fury blazed through Dimera's brain, burning away any ghosts of uncertainty. She raised her blast pistol and fired. It was a long shot for her sidearm, but the bolt of dark light struck home. The orc looked down at one of its armour plates, which Dimera noticed with the faintest scrabblings of trepidation was now smoking and cratered, but had not been pierced. Drukhari armour was far more efficient and advanced than these crude slabs of metal, but if the metal was thick enough and you were strong enough to haul it around like a walking tank, the protection it offered would nonetheless be formidable. The orc raised its own weapon and pulled the trigger. Something on it spun around very fast, and Dimera leaped aside just in time to avoid the emergence of a crackling black void. It lasted only for a second, but when it cleared, it had chewed away a ragged hole in the ground into which she could easily have fitted, leaving behind nothing but the stench of the warp. By Cain, did even these brutes' weapons use teleportation technology? Dimera sprang forward, eager to close the gap between them. A few of her warriors had survived the impact and the fall, and were already raking the mass of orcs around them with toxic splinters from their weapons. If she could bring the orc chieftain down, then not only could she hold it over her brother, but, as everyone knew, the orcs would also devolve into internecine warfare as the beast's lieutenants fought amongst themselves to take its place. That should at least slow them down enough for Dimera to solidify her authority, gather a greater force, and return to wipe them out. The orc gave a massive grunt of effort and hurled its enormous axe-bladed hammer at her. Dimera was caught off guard by the tactic. Who threw their melee weapon when they still had a gun? And the improvised projectile came at her with such force and speed that her evasive roll was almost clumsy.
She came back up to her feet with a predatory grin, for although it was still a formidable opponent, the orc had just thrown away its best means of hurting her in close. The orc did something with its hand, and the weapon reappeared. However, it reappeared directly above the orc's head and fell hammer end first onto the brute's skull, prompting a bellow of rage and anger. Dimera was brought up short in astonishment. The orc had fitted some sort of teleportation device to its hammer, apparently simply so it could throw it at an enemy and then retrieve it? That spoke to a far more advanced mastery of warp technology than that with which anyone had credited the Arrakia, yet it was being utilized for such a trivial purpose. How could these creatures possess that level of understanding, but be so completely blasé about the dangers associated with it? Did they truly not fear the attentions of demons? Did they fear anything? The moment of surprised inattention nearly cost her. Not at the hands of the orc chieftain, who had kicked its weapon back up into its fist with the sort of glower that dared anyone or anything else to mention what had just happened, but a mob of its underlings, which had got just close enough to swarm onto Dimera while she was distracted. There were at least a dozen of them, all big brutes covered in scars that looked like the aftermath of ferocious bites, and many with blocky but apparently effective mechanical prosthetics. The first one swung a massive chain blade at her in a flat backhanded blow, and Dimera's reflexes kicked back into action. She swayed backwards like a sapling in a strong wind, letting the chain blade sweep past just above her face, then straightened and thrust with her venom blade in the same motion. The tip went in through the orc's left eye, the right being another of those prosthetics, and into the brain, but Dimera whipped the blade out again immediately rather than risk losing it to the creature's death spasms. The orcs were a tide, but she was the wind. They were a landslide, but she was lightning. Her blast pistol took one full in the face, blowing its skull apart, but even as it fell, she was already jerking her head aside to let the solid slug of a different enemy's sidearm flash just past her ear. She pivoted, cutting across the belly of one orc with the tip of her blade as it tried to get behind her, sidestepped the heavy downward swing of another's axe, and then, as its blade threw up chips from the ground, swung the elbow of her pistol arm to open its throat with one of her armor's razor-sharp protuberances. She pivoted again, and the next shot missed her arched back by a hair's breadth to detonate in the stomach of another of her assailants. She leaped into the air to evade a clumsy swing at her legs, stunned one orc with a kick to the jaw while she was up there and broke its neck with a follow-up roundhouse from the other foot, then turned her blast pistol on the orc that had attempted to cut her down. It was still stooped over, and the dark light bolt struck the crown of its head and bored right through its torso from top to bottom. She landed on its blade, scooped it up into the air with her foot just as the orc chieftain had done with its hammer, then used another kick to propel the weapon straight into the face of the one which had been shooting at her. The beast went down howling as the powered teeth soared into its neck. She took both eyes from one attacker with a single slash of her blade across its ugly bestial face and blocked the swing of another's weapon with a thrust kick to the inside of its elbow that snapped its arm, then shot a hole right through the one which looked like it might be their leader before delivering a jumping knee strike to the lower jaw of the one whose arm she had just broken, which was the only one still standing. Her patella blade speared through the soft flesh of its throat, up through its mandible and tongue, and on into the roof of its mouth, and she savoured a moment of its pain, but she could tell within an instant that the brute's head was too large, its brain was too small, or both. This blow had not killed it, and she hastily disengaged before the one hand that remained fully under its control could seize her. The orc took a lurching step towards her, its arm and fingers outstretched, and Dimera readied herself to open its throat and evade its clumsy grasp in the same balletic movement. The massive shape of the orc chieftain loomed up behind its wounded minion and clubbed it out of the way with a two-handed swing of its enormous hammer. The force of the blow lifted the smaller orc off its feet and deposited it several yards away, which was no inconsiderable feat given how much it must have weighed. And the chieftain let loose a bellowed challenge so deep and powerful that Dimera felt it in her bones. The meaning was clear, even to Dimera. No other orc should attack her, lest it suffer the rage of their leader. That was fine by her. There were sufficient orcs all around to swamp even a warrior of her skill, but she was confident of her chances in single combat. That confidence lasted until the orc attacked. One moment it was stationary, other than its nostrils flaring as it sucked in her scent and its fingers tightening slightly around the haft of its weapon. Then, without warning, it was in motion. The axe blade flashed towards her head, the orc's stupendous reach combining with the sheer length of the haft to immediately endanger her. But it was the speed of the creature that was the most terrifying. Something that large should not be able to move that fast. It should not be possible. And yet, Dimera found herself backpedaling, desperately trying to stay out of reach, with all thoughts of piercing its flesh with her blade abandoned. This was not a fight, she realised within moments. This was the orc trying to swat an annoyance. She was able to stay ahead of it, just, but the monstrous brute gave no signs of slowing down, and her venom blade could not even reach the hands holding its hammer, let alone any more central part of its anatomy. The hammer itself seemed to tear the air as it was swung, and the gusts of wind it raised buffeted her as she dodged, ducked, and rolled away from it. She fired her blast pistol, but although the bolt struck home, they seemed to do little more than aggravate the beast. She was confident that her venom blade would take its toll, but she couldn't land a blow, and if the orc made the merest contact with its own weapon, then it would surely incapacitate her enough for it to finish her off. What was more, all it had to do was get impatient and call on its underlings to join the fray after all, and Dimera would be done for. For perhaps the first time in her life, Dimera Frakes found herself utterly at the mercy of another living being. And she hated it. She wondered if the orc could smell her growing fear. Was it relishing her embarrassment? Did it revel in its own ability to have a master archon of the Drukhari desperately scrambling to avoid its blows? Or was it utterly oblivious to such things, seeking only the thrill of the fight? Then, in a desperate snatch glance beyond the orc's left shoulder, Dimera saw something that rekindled the faint light of hope within her. She snapped another shot off at the orc's face, which it avoided with a casual-seeming twitch of a neck as thick as her waist, but she had only been trying to distract it for a moment longer. The rest of her force swept in. They had attacked on three fronts, each one seeking the orc's leader with the intention of executing it. She had been successful in locating the beast, and now, finally, the others were arriving to reinforce her. There were the rest of her vessels, along with those from the Cabal of the Falling Night and Coven of the Red Harvest. A Ravager, flying low, fired all three of its disintegrator cannons into the orc chieftain's back. For a moment, Dimera was outraged. Despite the fact that she had been on the back foot, this was her fight and her kill. Then her thoughts leapt to the pragmatic. She could execute the captain of the Ravager concerned, and it would still have been her leadership that led to the beast's downfall and struck the first real blow against the invaders. Then, as the orc failed to keel over in a smoking ruin, but instead bellowed in rage and whirled around, true terror gripped her. What would it take to actually hurt this creature? Nonetheless, it had presented her with its back for the first time in their confrontation. A back with armour that was now scorched, warped, and weakened. She leaped forward to bury her venom blade in the monster's flesh, screaming with rage and suppressed fear as she did so. The thing came at her from her left, a squealing ball of muscle and teeth that clamped its massive jaws down on her sword arm and wrenched her sideways. Her blow missed its target, and although she clubbed the orcish creature between the eyes with the butt of her blast pistol to make it let go, her chance had gone. The orc chieftain whipped back around with blazing eyes and swung its hammer again. This time, the weapon's head made contact with Dimera's venom blade, knocking it from her grasp and shattering it in the same instant. Then, as she scrambled back up to her feet, it raised its hammer again with a roar of fury.
Thrakes!
The shout came a moment before a massive dark grey craft hurtled into view, moving fast enough to get to her even before the orc could finish its blow. Dimera's hand was seized by fingers of pale ice blue, and she was yanked off her feet and away. The orc's swing buried itself in the ground, causing a small crater of its own, and Dimera found herself being hauled over the railings of a Tantalus by none other than Sistriel Verne himself. Dimera took a breath and steadied herself as the Tantalus banked, then realised that her hand and Verne's were still entwined at the same moment as Verne did, judging by how hastily both of them dropped the other's grasp and took a half step away. Contact poisons to dispose of rivals were far from unheard of. Dimera began, struggling to find words. She had intervened to kill the orc that had been going to take Verne's life, but Drukhari were not bound by debts of honour. Any alliances were made beforehand and usually contracted in exhaustive detail, so that each party knew exactly what would count as a betrayal. By rights, Verne should have let her die and count himself free of a rival.
"We are outmatched," Verne said stiffly yet hastily,
as though seeking to explain his own actions.
"We have killed many, but we cannot strike the telling blow. We need the witch cults and as many blades for hire as we can muster. Your influence will be needed for that,"
he added, with a momentary sideward glance at Dimera.
"It would be imprudent to let you perish at this time."
"I understand," Dimera said, swallowing down a tightness in her throat. After all, she had come very close to the sort of death that would be inconvenient for even a homunculus to retrieve her from, given where her remains would have ended up. "However, we have not completely failed." She activated her carrier waves.
"All vessels. The orcish construction with the pylons is their teleportation device. Focus all fire upon it."
Ravagers and Reapers swept in, concentrating their weapons on the contraption. It looked shoddily built, but like many such things of orcish construction, it took a lot more shots than Dimera would have expected before it finally exploded. A shockwave of trapped energy ripped outwards, levelling everything around it for several dozen yards, including, she noted with fierce satisfaction, the strange artillery piece that had brought her raiders down.
"There," she said, in a hollow voice. "That will contain them for now."
She looked at Verne, but the other Archon was staring out over the carnage, apparently ignoring her. No one else was going to take responsibility for giving this order.
"All craft, retreat."
Chapter 11. Ilioneth Zesk lay still, watched the remaining vessels of the Port Tavar forces flee back through the Webway portal without him, and silently cursed Archon Dimera Thrakes into the soul-sucking embrace of She Who Thirsts. Typical Archon. He had served her loyally for centuries, not once putting into practice the various schemes he had devised to bring about her downfall and see him ascend to take her place at the head of the Cabal. Granted, that was partly because she was extremely paranoid, and Zesk had very few allies he could trust, even amongst his trueborn. However, he had never let his greed overcome his caution, and as a result, he had discharged his duty to the highest standards without making even an imperfect grab for power. And now he was being left behind, abandoned like a promise. His lack of motion was not completely down to his injuries, although they were severe. He had been thrown from the Venom as it was wrecked against the Arrakia's energy field and landed in a crush of orcs. Now his armour was smashed and pierced in a multitude of places. At least one leg was useless. His left hand was missing, and a great rent had been torn in his side by the tip of one of the crude orcish hand weapons. But he was not as dead as the others around him, be they Drukhari or Arrakia. Zesk was intelligent enough to realise that what the orcs craved most was combat, and that an enemy who was apparently unable to give them this satisfaction was largely beneath their notice. A Drukhari force would take their time gathering the wounded to torment them further and feast their souls upon the wretched unfortunate's agony. The same was true for many of the followers of the Gods of Chaos. Orcs, though, were more eager to press on to the next fight and find someone new against whom they could test themselves. If Zesk remained still and avoided notice, the odds were good that none of the brutes would come poking around to find out if anyone was still alive. All he had to do was wait for them to leave somehow. Their ingenuity on that front might actually serve him well in this specific scenario, or be exterminated by the larger force that the rooted Archons would surely even now be trying to assemble. His wounds were severe, but nothing that even a junior homunculus couldn't deal with, should he merely be able to get to one. It might take time, and that time would be spent in great pain, but Ilioneth Zesk was no stranger to pain. Granted, he was more usually inflicting it than the other way around, but nothing lasted long in the Dark City without the ability to endure pain to one degree or another. Zesk had survived centuries so far, and he was not going to be cheated out of his rightful place at the head of a cabal just by an invasion of simple-witted brutes who happened to be good at destroying things. He became aware of a noise approaching, distinct, even over the background roar and rumble of the orcs doing whatever it was they were doing now their enemies had disappeared again. It was a shuffling, a scuttling, a whispering and a snickering, and even amidst the carnage wrought by an invading force of savages, something about it made Zesk's hackles stand up. He groped around with his right hand, trying to remain unobtrusive. His blast pistol had been crushed, although the orc responsible died when the weapon exploded in its face, and he'd lost his power sword when a chain-bladed cleaver made a mockery of his armour and took his left hand off at the wrist. Still, there must be something within reach with which he could arm himself. Was that small, thin object under his fingers the hilt of one of his belt knives with which he had brought down the last of his assailants before collapsing and resigning himself to ingloriously playing dead while his so-called allies fled? The noise got closer. It was a high-pitched chittering, like Drukhari children who had found a pit of dirgeworms or something equally harmless, which could be tormented with no risk to their own safety. But he did not recognise it as coming from any creature native to Camorra. The hoped-for belt knife turned out to be nothing but a shard of armour, either his own or someone else's, Zesk was unsure. But it was long and sharp, and it would serve adequately to puncture the exposed flesh of a largely unarmoured creature such as an orc. He fumbled it into place between his fingers, ready to slash or stab as appropriate. With any luck, whatever was coming would pass him by, as uninterested in apparently dead and broken bodies as was any other part of the orcish war machine. The shuffling and chittering was to his left now, and close enough that he thought he might be able to see the source without making any movements that would give him away as still living. He rolled his eyes in that direction, cursing the slightly shifted helm on his head that now marginally impeded his view. Something moved, skittering through the very limits of his vision. It was green, he could tell that much. The bright, vivid green of living orcoid flesh, not the muted colours of the cabal of the fallen night. The enemy was close. The enemy was very close. An upside-down face appeared above his, peering down. Ragged bat-wing ears flanked beady red eyes, set on either side of a dagger-like nose so long it was nearly scraping his helmet's faceplate. The enemy was short. It wasn't an orc, Sesk realised. It was one of their diminutive slave caste, surprisingly dangerous in large numbers, but a negligible threat when alone. He forced himself to remain still in case a sign of life would encourage the slave to call one of its masters. Zesk had no illusions that he would be able to defeat one of them, should a hail specimen register that he was still alive. The slave, the grot, was that the word, nudged his helmet with its foot. Zesk allowed his head to be rolled to one side, despite the utter fury that raged up inside him at such indignity, sufficient to eclipse even the pain of his wounds. He had taken this war plate from the body of his predecessor, and it was one of the finest examples of the Drukhari's armourer's art, eclipsed within the cabal of the Hollow Heart only by the suits of Dimera Thrakes and her junior archons, such as her brother. It galled him to allow it to be sullied by a grot's foot without inflicting punishment on the creature for its transgression, but this was the sensible course of action. Play dead, let its limited intelligence grow bored with prodding an apparent corpse, and let it move on once something else caught its attention. The grot leaped into the air with a giggle and came down with its full weight on Zesk's chest. The breath he'd been holding in his lungs to avoid a telltale movement of his breastplate shot out of him in a rushing wheeze, and the wound in his side spat fire through his nervous system. He lashed out with his shiv, his instinctive reaction fully backed up by deliberate anger and spite, and the warp take whatever attention he might attract. The shard of armour went in through one side of the grot's throat and punched out of the other, driven by the power of his hate-fueled muscles, and the pathetic little creature fell backwards off his makeshift blade with a wet gurgle, clutching at the twin wounds he had opened in its flesh. Zesk collapsed backwards, most parts of him now in agony and with renewed bleeding from his injuries, but with a grim satisfaction at the life he had just taken. He could hear the grot scrabbling desperately around, even if he couldn't see it, but he had no doubt that it would succumb to its wounds soon. Once it did, there was no chance of any of the orcs noticing it. They barely seemed to pay attention to their slaves while they were alive, so another corpse would attract no attention at all. Still, that dying grot did seem to be making a lot of noise. Zesk managed to raise his head slightly, sufficient to get a better view of his surroundings. The dim light from above was blocked out by multiple small bodies launching themselves at him. He tried to raise his arms to fend them off, but blood loss-induced weakness and severed muscle fibres foiled him, and the grots landed across him, pinning him down. He tried to thrash and throw them off, but his body refused to obey him. His right arm was trapped, and he felt clawed fingers prising his hand open with surprising strength. The little creatures lacked much in the way of physicality, but they could grip on desperately to fast-moving vehicles or throttle the life out of one of their own kind. And that same wiry tenaciousness allowed them to snatch an improvised weapon away from a wounded Drukhari warrior. He continued to struggle, but to no avail. There were half a dozen of the little wretches, and while he might have made short work of them had he been upright, uninjured and armed, he was in no condition to fight them off as he was. He braced himself for the ultimate indignity of having his throat cut by such a pitiful foe and being left to bleed out properly beyond the reach of even the most amateurish homunculus. However, no blade pierced his flesh, and no long-fingered green hands closed around his throat to finish him off in a more personal fashion. Instead, a new surge of agony washed through him as he was wrenched around on the ground. Zesk gritted his teeth, determined not to give these miniature monstrosities the satisfaction of hearing him cry out in pain, but the torment did not let up. Now he was actually being moved, dragged and pulled over and past the bodies of those who had fallen in combat around him, while the grots chuckled and gibbered to themselves. Their tongue was garbled and animalistic, of course, but through the haze of suffering washing over him, Zesk was able to discern a repeated phrase, started by one voice and taken up by the others. It had a viciously gleeful sound to it, as though it were a war cry raised up in celebration.
Spikey! Spikey! Spikey!
Chapter 12. Snaggy Littletooth had to suppress the urge to jump and skip with glee as he led his daring raiding party back through the devastation. They'd found a spiky. What was more, they'd found one that was still alive, but too damaged to do more than wiggle a bit. It turned out to have one good stab left in it, as you might expect from a spiky, and Moz had found out firsthand what happened when you jumped on one of the gits without making sure it was properly dead first. However, Snaggy had managed to heroically subdue the vicious alien warrior. Fine, he was prepared to concede that the other lads might have helped, and now they were transporting their prize back to the rest of his new band of followers with their heads held high. This was one of the few times when being a grot actually came in handy. Well, Snaggy knew that being a grot was always better than being an orc, or indeed being anything else, because how could it be otherwise? If being a grot wasn't the best thing, then why would he be a grot? That sort of logic was inescapable. But Snaggy was also aware, and this was where his towering intellect came in. His ability to see past how he wanted things to be and focus on the objective reality of stuff. That being a grot was not always such a good thing in the galaxy as it was. Somehow, the orcs had turned natural order on its head and put themselves in charge, even though grots were clearly superior and certainly smarter. That was the sort of injustice that gave him the fiery righteous rage within, which motivated him to fight on against oppression, no matter the odds. However, the specific circumstances of why being a grot was currently coming in handy was a direct result of this injustice, which only proved to Snaggy how great he was, since he was using the orcs' own prejudices against them to ultimately bring about their downfall. Orcs only paid attention to grots when they wanted something done for them, or the grots were in the way, in the orcs' opinion, or they lacked any better options for a bit of target practice or general kicking. The Wah's simple presence in this strange place had given the orcs plenty of good targets and fun new things to blow up, so the last one wasn't a problem, and orcs would rarely go searching for a grot even if they did want something done. They were more likely to just give the grot a beating when he eventually showed up as punishment for not being around when he should have been. That meant, so long as Snaggy and his lads weren't getting underfoot, they probably wouldn't be high on anyone's list to start shouting orders at or demand to know what they were up to. "Where are we taking this git anyway?" Bees demanded, hauling backwards on the spiky's head to drag it over a bit of rubble.
"Back to the lads for starters," Snaggy said.
He had ended up pulling on the arm without a hand, which was entirely coincidental and nothing at all to do with it being probably the least dangerous of the spiky's extremities. The git was still trying to thrash around, but grots were naturally good at holding on to things trying to get away from them, such as squigs, food, or another grot that had just nicked your food.
"Then we'll find a portal and get out of here."
"Why?"
Swipe demanded.
"We've got him. Why not just get out ourselves?"
Snaggy smiled sagely. Clearly the time had come to dispense a pearl of wisdom.
"See, this is where I can help you. If you're going to be me underbosses, then you're going to need to learn this next part. What have we got here?"
"A spiky,"
Swipe said, pushing on the leg he was holding. It didn't look to Snaggy as though the spiky's leg was supposed to bend that way, but that was the spiky's problem.
"Right, but it ain't the spiky that's important, is it?"
Snaggy said coaxingly.
"It's what it can do for us. If this was grub, then yeah, makes sense that we keep it between us, because we're the important ones. But we ain't chopping this git up and sharing it out, are we? Nah, we're using it to do a thing. A thing what's going to be really impressive to all those cowards what didn't come with us. And stuff like that only gets better if there's more grots around when you do it. Because then there's even more of them to be impressed by it and say things like, 'Wow, that Snaggy and the underbosses really know what they're doing. We should stick with them and follow their orders because they'll make things really good for us.'"
"I don't know,"
Nib said dubiously, wrangling the spiky's other leg.
That just sounds like less loot and grub and stuff once we get away from the orgs.
He clamped one hand over his mouth as soon as he'd spoken, as though a runt herd was going to show up and clobber him for uttering such impudence, and nearly dropped the spiky's leg in the process. Snaggy sighed and shook his head.
Lads, 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 how are we going to get the loot and grub? Sure, we could try and nick it ourselves, but that ain't the smart thing. The smart thing is to get the others to do the nicking for us. There's no war boss in the galaxy what goes around and nicks everything himself, right? They get the best bits from everyone else, so that's what we're going to do too. You lot are going to help me prove that I know these special secrets what the gods have told me. And then all the grots with any sense will follow us. I'm the grot boss, because after all, he patted himself smugly on the chest, I'm the one what knows things. And you lot are me underbosses, because you showed the vision to back me from the start.
There was a general nodding of heads and chuntering of approval amongst Snaggy's underbosses as they grot-handled the still-bleeding Spikey around a corner, although Snaggy noticed there were already a few questions being asked along the lines of why they should be the ones who had to cart the Spikey around. He smiled, because that was good. That showed motivation. Namely, the motivation to make some other git do the work, which, in Snaggy's opinion, was the only motivation worth having. He'd tried too hard before. He'd assumed that because Gawk and Mork spoke to him, he had to do everything himself. Well, that had been a mistake. He recognised that now. He wouldn't make the same error again. Now he had his underbosses, or useful idiots, as he was referring to them in the privacy of his own head, he could get them to do stuff for him. But they would do it because they could then get other grots to do those things for them in turn. Say what you liked about orcs, and Snaggy would, so long as none of the big gits were around, but their hierarchy system worked. He needed layers beneath him, so he could be at the top without having to concentrate on everything at once, like one of those tin-head buildings with all the steps going up to the top. What were they called? Ziggurat, that was it. Snaggy's scheme for becoming the grot boss was a ziggurat plan.
Next lesson, lads, he said proudly. We're going to start getting loot off this right from the start. Anyone who wants to come with us through the portal's going to have to pay up. That's going to make them even more eager to find some loot once we get out of here, and we can have some of...
He broke off, as a small group of figures rose into view out of the ruins around them.
Well, well, said a voice. What's going on here, then?
The voice belonged to a beefy grot, or what passed for beefy amongst grots, wearing a blood-stained apron, on the belt of which hung a variety of tools. A small saw, whose rusty teeth had gobbets of flesh stuck between them, a long-bladed, single-edged cutting blade that looked a little keener and narrower than your standard grot stabber, a pair of pliers which made Snaggy's teeth hurt just to look at, and on, a veritable arsenal of things that could be used to poke and pry into bits of a body which the brain boys had never intended to see the light of day, and surely too many for a grot with only two hands with which to wield them.
Oh, sog,
Longtooth said in a small voice.
It's the disorderlies. That's right, Squirt,
the newcomer sneered.
Top grots of the top dock. Hooah!
Hooah! The other grots with him chorused, punching the air as one. Snaggy kept his expression neutral. The disorderlies were the hench grots of Doc Drosfang, the pain boy who appeared to have had some hand in Uftak Blackhawk's rise to prominence. Snaggy had gathered that, as a result of this, the Doc was regarded as the preeminent practitioner of his trade in this part of the Tekwar, treated with some level of respect by other pain boys and normal orcs alike, and the disorderlies clearly felt that sort of status rubbed off on them. None of them would dream of trying to push an orc around, of course, but other grots...
What's up?
Snaggy said cheerfully, deciding to approach this as though there were nothing at all menacing about the disorderly's appearance or general mannerisms.
What you doing with that git?
The head disorderly demanded, pointing at the spiky with one claw.
Not a lot,
Snaggy said quickly.
Just having a bit of fun, that's all. A bit of fun,
the disorderly repeated eagerly.
So he's still alive?
Snaggy glanced sideways at Gip, seeking advice from someone who had been around this particular walk for longer. Gip shook his head almost imperceptibly, confirming Snaggy's suspicions. Working for a doc as they did, the disorderlies were going to be more interested in living bodies than corpses.
Nah,
he said casually.
Not anymore. It's still leaking a bit, but it's definitely carked it. Just taking it back to the boss so he can put the helmet and whatnot on his boss pole and there.
He tried an ingratiating grin.
You know how it is.
The disorderly focused on Snaggy's teeth in a way that reminded Snaggy very abruptly of the pliers on the other grot's belt, and snorted.
Dead, you reckon? We'll see about that. Sneezer?
Another grot hurled a chunk of rubble with what Snaggy had to grudgingly admit was an impressive degree of accuracy, in that it landed right on the spiky's chest. The spiky, which had sunk into the sort of torpor common to those who had lost a lot of blood and become largely resigned to their fate, reacted to this by trying to thrash again. It was a fairly pitiful effort, but one that could not be disguised. Still, Snaggy did his best.
Swipe!
He snapped, redoubling his grip on the arm.
Stop wiggling the body, that ain't funny.
I didn't do enough. I mean, yes, Snaggy, sorry, Snaggy,
Swipe said, picking up on the true meaning of Snaggy's furious glare a second too late. Not that it probably would have made much difference anyway, judging by the gleeful crows that had broken out amongst the disorderlies.
You see that, Sneezer?
The leader asked, jovially.
I did indeed, Squeezer,
the grot known as Sneezer replied, rubbing his hands together before pulling a length of metal fashioned into a crude club from his belt.
It's alive and kicking. Ledge! You don't understand,
Snaggy began, turning back to the disorderlies.
We gotta take this git to the big boss, even if it ain't dead.
Gonna be honest, that sounds like a you problem,
Squeezer said, slipping the long-bladed scalpel from his belt.
The doc wants a spiky what's still alive, and this one ain't gonna put up much of a fight. Stand aside, and we'll let you keep your hands.
That's a good deal,
Nib offered tentatively.
I quite like me hands. Shut it,
Snaggy hissed. He debated the likelihood of impressing the encroaching disorderlies with his grot boss spiel, but disregarded it. These gits had a taste of power, tarnished and second-hand though it might be, and that would be enough to blind them to the reality of his glory. What was more, they might even take word of his plan to Drosfang or some other orc who just might pay enough attention to care about it, and that would be disastrous.
And the bosses,
he announced, dropping the spiky's arm and drawing his weapons.
Let him have it!
Whether or not his companions would have followed his lead and actually attacked became something of a moot point, because, as Snaggy had planned, the disorderlies reacted to his defiance by lurching into a screaming charge of their own, waving their implements of pain and dubious medical provenance as they did so. Grots that might not have taken up arms to defend a nearly dead spiky for an as-yet untested purpose were far more eager to pull weapons to defend themselves, and the two somewhat ragged battle lines were drawn. Snaggy fired his blaster, but Squeezer was very inconsiderately not exactly where the round went, and it only clipped the other grot's left shoulder. Squeezer howled in pain but kept coming, his expression an equal split between bloodlust and fear of the consequences of his own failure, and Snaggy didn't have time for a second shot before the larger grot was upon him. He backpedaled desperately from Squeezer's first slash, a diagonal blow that could have caused Snaggy's right hip to abruptly cease to be on speaking terms with his left shoulder, and tried to put his stabber through the other grot's chest. Squeezer managed to knock his thrust away, then grabbed the wrist of Snaggy's gun hand as he tried to aim his weapon point blank at Squeezer's head. Snaggy dropped his stabber to seize the hand clutching the scalpel just before the blade got plunged into his side, and a pair of them staggered around in a half circle, each trying to get their weapon into the right position to deliver a killing blow.
The trouble was that while Squeezer was only beefy by grot standards, Snaggy was a part of those grot standards, and he was very definitely physically outmatched by his opponent. The blaster was gradually forced farther away from Squeezer's head, and the blade of the scalpel began to prick at Snaggy's ribs. This was a situation that required all the cunning and ingenuity which had got Snaggy to where he was today.
"The spiky!" he wailed. "It's getting away!"
The fear of failure exploded in Squeezer's eyes and drowned out the bloodlust, and instinctively looked around to check on the status of his desired prize. The spiky was still where it had been, of course, but the momentary distraction allowed Snaggy to lean forward and clamp his teeth shut on Squeezer's ear. The larger grot jerked away in panic and pain, and only succeeded in leaving half his ear behind, clamped between Snaggy's teeth. He howled, and his grip on Snaggy's wrist slackened for half a second, allowing Snaggy to twist the weapon around and pull the trigger. It wasn't a well-aimed shot, but at this range it didn't have to be. A fist-sized section of Squeezer's chest vanished, and this time the other grot's spasm was the result of life rapidly leaving his body. Squeezer slumped backwards, and Snaggy raised his hands in triumph and did a little dance.
"Yeah! How'd you like that, you git? That's what you get when..."
He tailed off as he looked around him and saw most of his underbosses fleeing, with bees lying face down on the ground with a long shiv sticking out of his back. Fury rose in Snaggy. He'd worked so hard. He'd found them the spiky. He'd killed a grot much bigger than him to keep it, and now the gits were running away.
"Cowards!"
he bellowed at their rapidly retreating backs.
"Come back! Come back and fight! Grots ain't dangerous!"
Something hit him in the back of the head, and then the ground loomed up and headbutted him in the face. Chapter 13. Uftak stared at the ruins of the teleport platform and fumed. It hadn't been a perfect solution to the problem, but it had been something. Sure, they'd been firing mobs off into who knows where, even more disorganised than Awar usually was, but it had been progress of a sort. Uftak had hoped that one of them might have had the brains to secure the portal and open it from the other side, but maybe he'd been expecting too much. After all, he suspected that it wasn't as though the spikies had just thrown a bolt or something. Maybe what they needed was a spiky. But did they just need to be near the portal, or did they have to do a special thing?
"Nisqueak!" he bellowed, and waited.
He didn't have to wait long. The little git clambered out from where it had been taking shelter behind the still-smoking body of a meganob who'd taken a direct hit from a big spiky gun, and hurried up to where Uftak was standing.
"Yes, boss?"